thought I'd do some review of Fourier series today and start reviewing this week. The final exam, the in-class part, let's see, it's Wednesday, May 3rd, 1 to 3 p.m. in our regular room. This is Rec 121, right?
I think. And I've already started grading the take-home part that you did and turned in on Sunday. And I'll give you a tentative grade that you would have if you didn't take the written in-class final. And you can decide if you want to try to improve your grade by taking the in-class written final.
Can I hurt your grade?
Thinking about that, whether... I'll try to come up with some reasonable formula. I'm thinking the written exam, the in-class written exam could only improve your grade. So, I think that's the way I'll do it. Yeah.
Will the written thing be like about that difficult?
No, there'll be some. I think the written test would be more straightforward than that. But this material I'm gonna review would get you ready for that. I'm also gonna allow you one crib sheet written on both sides. So, crib sheet, a two-sided. Handwritten crib sheet will be allowed. So so one of the problems I wanted to review was one of the things that kind of usually belongs in the text, namely number 14 on page 91. And that's a very straightforward way to show that if F is a C1 smooth, meaning it has a continuous derivative, 2π periodic function, then the Fourier series for it converges absolutely. Its Fourier series converges absolutely to F. And of course, Stein gives you all the bare minimum of hints you need to figure this out. So let's, first hint is to use Parsevals on F prime. So remember Parsevals, so one piece is Parsevals, which said that if F was two is continuous, and 2π periodic, then the sum of its Fourier coefficients squared equals 1 over 2π times the integral from minus pi to pi of f of x squared dx. Maybe it's worth reminding you where that came from, because it's kind of all the concepts related to getting Parsevals were very important. We had that Fourier series gave the best L2 approximation to a function. So this is called best L2 approximation property. Of Fourier series. And it is, let's see, remember, if I take the L2 norm of F minus the sum from minus n to n, and here's the Fourier coefficients. Oops. Oh, darn, how did this happen? I'm going to get jumps today. So let's see. You can calculate that with your bare hands by doing an inner product. And when we did that, that was equal to F squared. That's the L2 norm of F squared minus the sum from minus n to n of the Fourier coefficients modulus squared. And the deal is, that's the Fourier series approximation. That's always a better approximation than any other trig polynomial of degree n. So this is the less. This will always be less than or equal to f minus some other trig polynomial that maybe is not the Fourier series. Let's see. So here we'd have any old coefficients. How about bn's e to the inx?
And the way we got Parseval's inequality was to realize if, say, if f is continuous, we can approximate it by Thayer's theorem by a trig polynomial, as close as we want. And so we can make this thing, say, smaller than epsilon by taking a trig polynomial. We might have to take a high-power trig polynomial, but let's say we get one of order n that makes this smaller than epsilon. Well, then the Fourier series of order n or higher would be even closer, because a trig polynomial of order n is also a trig polynomial of order bigger than n. So it shows that this is smaller than epsilon. And that's how we prove Parseval's identity. It means that this is always as small as we want, which means when I put this on the other side, I get that this squared is the sum of the Fourier series squared. Well, I guess, let's see, when I normalize, I need a 1 over 2 pi in there. So don't think about the 2 pi right now. This is when I divide these by their norms. Okay, so I'm going to use Parseval's in a second. So that, let's see, that's, I would call that piece number 1 of this business. Piece number 2 is that the Fourier coefficients of the derivative are easy to figure. So part number 2 is that if I take f prime and look at its Fourier coefficient, it's the same thing you would get if you differentiated the Fourier series term by term. And let's see, when you differentiate e to the inx, an in comes out in front.
So this thing is in times the Fourier coefficient of n, the nth Fourier coefficient.
And since f is continuously differentiable, that would be a true formula. The way we calculated this, remember, was to calculate f.
Let's see, this would be f prime hat of n would be integral from minus pi to pi of f prime of x e to the minus inx dx.
And you integrate by parts once, and the n comes out. Or 1 over in comes out.
So it's a very straightforward thing to check. integrate by parts. That's how you deduce that. And because f is continuously differentiable, the integration by parts business is the classic freshman calculus version of integration by parts. Okay, so that we're getting someplace now. So when we add 1 plus 2, we get by Parseval's that, let's see, the summation of I n f hat of n squared is 1 over 2 pi times the integral from minus pi to pi of f prime of x squared dx.
That certainly shows that the Fourier coefficients of f go to zero fast. But I want to see that to get absolute convergence, I want to see that this Fourier series converges absolutely. I want to see that these things, what do I want to see?
So I got to think here. My plan is I want summation f hat of n to be finite.
Because then when I put e to the inx, that's just cosines and sines in front of that thing.
Because if I had this, then f hat, yeah, this term, f hat n e to the inx, this has modulus 1.
It's cosine ix, it's cosine nx plus I sine nx. And that has length 1, because cosine squared plus sine squared is 1.
And so this would be less than or equal to fn. Those are continuous functions.
And so the Weierstrass M test says they would converge uniformly.
So this would be the MN. And this thing right here is a continuous function. And we have here that the summation MNs are finite. So the Weierstrass M test would yield that the sum goes to a converges uniformly to a continuous function. That the summation e to the inx converges uniformly.
And it's a fact from basic analysis that continuous functions that converge uniformly converge to a continuous function.
So I'll put in parentheses to a continuous limit.
So that's what we're after. So the question is, how do we get it?
So that's the next piece of the puzzle, is how to get that the sum of f hat of n is finite from the fact that we just figured out the sum of n f n squared. Any ideas about how to do that?
Of course, Stein gives you the hint you need. He says Cauchy-Schwarz inequality.
The key is Cauchy-Schwarz.
Well, you've seen Cauchy-Schwarz in various forms over your studies.
And it always is, it works the same whenever you have an inner product space. And here's the way I like to write it. Vector 1 inner product with vector 2 absolute value is less than or equal to the length of vector 1 times the length of vector 2.
And this holds in any inner product space where you have the axioms of inner products. It's the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality.
So one version of it that's nice is that the integral from minus pi to pi of f of x times g hat bar, let's see, g conjugate x dx is less than or equal to the L2 norm of f times the L2 norm of g. Maybe that's called Cauchy's. I don't know. I don't think Cauchy and Schwarz did it exactly the same. They did it in other contexts. And another context where exactly the same thing is true is when you do the classic inner product. ANBN conjugate is less than or equal to the square root of the sum of an squared times the sum, this is the length of the vector.
And this is the one that's going to be relevant for us. Anybody see what I should do?
Let's see, so what am I messing around with? I've got summation n goes from minus n to capital N, n squared f hat n squared. Should I do? That's what I want to see is, no, I've got that's finite. I know that. What do I want? I want that this is finite. What should I do? I wonder how long we'd sit around before we figure this out.
I want to get this on the left side of the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. Any big ideas? I want to make it look like an inner product. A sum two thing. And I want to be really clever about it. What would you do? So this is supposed to look like an inner product, and the right-hand side is supposed to look like the length of a vector. And the length of a vector is going to have squares in it. Anybody see it? Goldstein. It might be a 15 or 20 minute thing to sit around and think about if you've never done it before.
Is it involved like writing like n is like 1 plus 1 n times on them?
It's something along that thought.
N squared will always, you know, unless n is 0, n squared will always be at least 1.
Definitely, yeah. N squared is bigger than n.
I'm including like even if n is negative, n squared will be positive.
Yeah.
And it will still be at least 1. So I guess we could say like sum of.
So you want to pull out like a soup thing. But
I guess I was thinking of something like sum of f hat of n is like less than or equal to sum of n squared f hat of n or something like that.
Ah, that's a true thing.
Because one would be less than n squared.
But your idea of adding and subtracting n or something is kind of on the right track, but you're in the wrong group. You're in the additive group. You want to do it in the multiplicative group. So I'm going to multiply and divide by n. So here's the key. I'll have summation f hat of n. And then I'm going to multiply by n and divide by n. This is going to be the vector a, and this is going to be the vector b. So let's see, this is going to be the an. This is going to be the bn. And the fact that we're adding over, our numbers are going from minus n to n, it doesn't matter how you parameterize your numbers. The Cauchy-Schwarz inequality is still, let's see, these, I don't have to take any absolute values here because these are all real and positive. So this is going to be less than or equal to the square root of the sum of 1 over n squared. And then we realize we've got it finally, because this one is going to be the sum from minus n to n of n squared, f hat of n squared. And that's what we know is finite. And this thing is a famous sum. It's like pi squared over 6 or something, right? Except twice. Let's see, what would it be? This is finite. We know this is finite by Parseval's. By the Parseval's for f prime. And this side, let's see if I, oops, obviously, what happened to my n? I shouldn't put my n equals 0 term in there, obviously, right? So, I better make n unequal to 0 here. But taking out one term isn't going to change the finiteness of it. And then this would be 2 times the square root of pi squared over 6. That's a that's less than that. Because the infinite sums would go to pi squared over 6. And so when I add my f hat of 0 term in here, it doesn't change the finiteness of this thing. So we're done. That's how you see that C1 functions have absolutely convergent Fourier series. Questions about that? That's a nice problem, I think. And that's a nice trick. That's a standard trick in analysis that if you know that something is in L1 on a finite interval, then it's also, here's a related fact. L1 of an interval is contained in L2 of an interval. If something is Lebesgue integrable, then it's got to be L2 Lebesgue integrable. And so that's the reason is the integral from a to b of f of x dx, that's the integral from a to b of the function 1 times the function f of x, dx. And the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality would say that that's less than or equal to the square root of the integral from a to b of 1 squared dx times the square root of integral from a to b of s squared dx. And if this thing's finite, obviously, and this thing, if f is an L2, then this is finite. And that's how you see that the L1 norm of f is finite. So let's see, we get an actual inequality here. We get that the L1 norm is less than or equal to the square root of b minus a times the L2 norm. So it's like, that would be called a continuous inclusion. So if a sequence of functions converges in L2, it also converges in L1 on a compact closed interval. Same trick. Let's see. So the next problem on this review list is in the same vein. We got F that's 2 pi periodic and satisfies a Lipschitz condition. So it's lip alpha, where alpha is between 0 and 1. Did it say that alpha could be 1? Less than or equal to 1. Which means that f of x minus f of y satisfies an inequality constant times x minus y to the alpha. Now we want to see that the Fourier series, the terms in the Fourier series go to zero. And the more rapidly, the bigger alpha is. So we want to see that the Fourier coefficients are less than or equal to a constant over n to the alpha power. So they go to zero somewhat rapidly. And the bigger the alpha is, the more rapidly they go. Well, Stein's first hint is to show that the Fourier coefficients are equal to minus 1 over 2 pi times the integral from minus pi to pi. You shift x a little bit, so put pi over n here. That's a little tiny amount. E to the minus I n x dx. How do you think you would show such a thing? I want to somehow relate this thing to the Fourier coefficient. And this thing looks exactly like the Fourier coefficient, except there's an x plus pi over n, where there should just be an x. Yeah, idea?
Do some sort of substitution, like u equal x plus pi over n.
Yeah. So let's see. Usually I like tau. So why don't I use... I'll let this be equal to... how about u? Then... So let's see. U is that. And so u is x plus pi over n. And therefore du is dx... And let's see, I need to get x. X would be u minus pi over n. And let's see, I also need to know when x is equal to minus pi, u would be minus pi plus pi over n. And when x is equal to plus pi, u would be equal to plus pi plus pi over n. Okay, that allows me to change variables in that integral, and then my integral is minus 1 over 2 pi integral, let's see, so when x is minus pi, u is minus pi plus pi over n. And this would be pi plus pi over n. And here I would have f of u. And here I have e to the minus I n x. And x is u minus pi over n. And du is dx. So now I'm getting somewhere. Let's see, this thing right here would be e to the minus I n times u times e to the, I got two minuses, I n pi over n. And that is e to the I pi, which is what?
Minus 1.
So that's, and look at,
I've got the Fourier coefficient, basically. The f of u, e to the I n, u, du. The only thing that screws it up is that the integral of integration is wrong. Now what do I do? Yeah, exactly. It's 2 pi periodic, so it doesn't matter if you shift the interval. This integral is this. By the way, this thing is 2 pi periodic, too. So f is 2 pi periodic, and this Fourier thingy is 2 pi periodic. So the product is 2 pi periodic, and that means that you can shift the...
Okay, so what do I get? This minus sign comes out and gets rid of my other minus sign, so I have 1 over 2 pi, and I can shift to minus pi over pi, because this thing is 2 pi periodic. And that's equal to f hat of n. So this I was able to shift because it's 2 pi periodic. Because the integrand is 2 pi periodic. Okay, so we have Stein's first hint. And so now here's the brilliant idea. Let's see. F hat. I've got two ways to write F hat. I'm going to take the average of the two ways to do it. So it's going to be the average of these two ways to write the Fourier coefficients. So let's see, that would be a half. One way to write it is the standard way. 1 over 2 pi integral from minus pi to pi, f of x, e to the I n x dx. And the way we just figured is this way. Minus 1 over 2 pi integral from minus pi to pi, f of x plus pi over n, e to the I n x dx. And so this is how we get Stein's next formula. You can tell that Stein must have read Zygmund's book backwards and forwards, because this is a standard trick in Fourier series that's kind of a little bit down the road. So you get integral from minus pi to pi, f of x minus f of x plus something small. And the bigger n is, the smaller that is. E to the I n x dx. And now our estimate is staring us in the face. This is the nth Fourier coefficient, so if I take the modulus of this thing and then put the less than or equal to the modulus of the stuff inside, would be less than or equal to 1 over 4 pi, integral from minus pi to pi, the modulus of this thing. And this is where I use the Lipschitz estimate. And this has modulus 1. And the Lipschitz estimate tells me that this is less than or equal to C times pi over n to the alpha. And there's my constant m. Would be this C from the Lipschitz estimate, a pi to the alpha, and that would be it. So we're done. The M in my estimate I'm seeking is C times pi to the alpha. And I didn't mean for C to be part of the review problem. That's sort of a carrier thing to think about. But you can find Lipschitz alpha functions where this, you can't get any better estimate than this.
Who's the author of that trigonometric polynomial
book again? Antoni Zygmunt. Yeah, it's a mind-blowing book. It has just so many clever, sneaky arguments just like this one. And this next one also. So something that I wanted to do in the middle of the course but didn't is this next exercise, problem 16. It's a kind of a thing that gets used a lot, but not many people know the proof very well. And Stein gives you exactly the right hints to be able to figure it out. So number 16 is that when alpha is 1, then this thing actually converges absolutely. So the alpha equal 1 case is even better. So the alpha equal 1 case we just got that the Fourier coefficient, the nth one, would be less than or equal to m over n if it's lip 1. Meaning alpha equals 1. And that's not a very good, that series, sum of 1 over n, is the famous divergent series. But summation of 1 over n is infinite. So it looks like maybe this thing is not absolutely convergent. Not absolutely convergent. But it is. And so we want to show that the summation of the Fourier coefficients of a lip 1 function is finite. Meaning that it satisfies an estimate like this. F of x minus f of y is less than or equal to a constant times x minus y. So for example, when functions have kinks, like the top of our TP function, it would satisfy an estimate like that. Because you just use the mean value theorem between two spots, and maybe one is at the kink, and the C would be the derivative at some place in between by the mean value theorem. And if those are bounded, then you get an estimate like this. So kinks, something that has like a TP kink, would satisfy a lip 1 estimate, even though it's not differentiable. And that's how you're going to see that, So they come up. They're ziggy-zaggy functions with kinks. And so they come up in practice quite a bit, especially in engineering. I don't want to rush through this, and I want to sit around and think about it a little bit. the first hint is the one that's going to give it. So the part A of the problem is to show that 1 over 2, let's see, we're going to let, g sub h of x is, you shift x to the, f to the right a little bit by h, and then you shift it a little bit to the left, and you subtract it. And the first hint is that 1 over 2 pi, integral from minus 0 to 2 pi, doesn't matter where you take it, of g sub h squared dx is going to be the sum. For sine n times h squared f hat n squared. That's what we want to see. What's screaming at you when you look at that? So this is, we want to show this. That's the first thing we want. Anything screaming at you to try?
Parsifal.
Yeah. The only time we ever see anything like this is in the Parsifals. So this is ordering you to do Parsifals. And let's see, when you do Parsifals, that's going to be equal to the sum of the Fourier coefficient squared of that difference quotient thing. And so let's see, what we have to figure out what the Fourier coefficients of the GH are. Let's think, GH hat of N, this is an H, this is an N. Let's see, what happens when you shift a function to the right by h, Fourier series people? I got an engineer in here. When you shift, yeah, what is it?
Like the Fourier coefficient is like, you can multiply by like a phase, like either 2 pi I.
Exactly.
H.
Yeah, yeah. So that's one of the basic properties of Fourier transform. Is it a plus or a minus? I'd have to rederive it because I never remember what it is.
It should be a minus, right? Because it's like, if you like...
If you do, yeah, I think you're right. So it'd be e to the minus I, is it pi? There's not going to be a pi.
No, there's no pi. Yeah, there's a pi.
I think it's going to be an e to the I n h, e to the minus I n h times f hat. That's the shift. And the other one is going to be e to the I n h f hat. And then you see, oh, there's a minus here.
There should be a pi, actually, because, like, if you, oh, no, it's over the interval zero. Never mind, yeah, okay, never mind.
Yeah, so this is going to be a minus. And so then you realize, aha, I've got an e to the I n h, maybe a minus of it, minus e to the minus I n h f hat n. And there's this, that's the sine function. So if I multiply and divide by 2i, then I get what I need. I get that g h hat of n is 2 times the sine of nh times the hat of this. And so when I take the sum of the squares in Parsifals, that's exactly what the right-hand side has given me. So I'd get a 4 sine nh squared f hat n squared. And so yes, sure enough, this is the sum of the g hat n squared. Check. Okay, so that gives us the big hint. And that big hint is just gonna spit this thing out if you look at it cleverly, as Stein instructs us to do in the rest of the hints.
Do we know that Parseval's identity holds for like a Lipschitz form function? Like, do we prove that?
Well, Lipschitz, we know Parseval's holds for continuous functions, and Lipschitz functions are continuous.
Yeah, okay.
They're not. You don't know they're differentiable, but they're definitely continuous.
Yeah.
So important to know.
Yeah.
Lipschitz functions are continuous.
Right.
That inequality shows that as you go toward a, f of x goes toward f of a.
Is being Lipschitz stronger than being continuous?
Yes. Lipschitz functions are continuous, but for example, lip alpha half wouldn't be lip alpha 1, maybe. Something like the square root of x is lip 1 half, but not lip 1.
Yeah.
So it's a weaker form of, it's bordering on being differentiable, but you can have derivatives that blow up at places. Yeah, so it's a measure of smoothness and differentiability that's weaker than being differentiable. And lip 1 is like almost differentiable, it just can be kinky. And the derivatives are controlled. They don't blow up. So we got our first hint out of the way, and I think I'll save the rest for next time. This is a really fascinating problem, and understanding this is exactly what it's about, to mess around with Fourier series and get deep into it. So it's a good thing to do at the end of the course. And it's all using things that we know. And that thing about shifting Fourier series, that's something you could put on your crib sheet if you wanted to. I could rederive it for myself in 5 minutes, and that's the way I do it rather than write it down and memorize it, because it's sort of a straightforward thing to do. But it's the kind of thing that's handy to have on the tip of your tongue if you're trying to be quick about stuff. Okay, I'll continue this problem next time and maybe do some other review things.
I was wondering if, I was like kind of stuck on the Lagrange polynomials, that identity, like with the inner products, like ln, like so integral from negative 1 to 1 of ln of x, f of x dx is equal to the integral from negative 1 to 1 of x squared minus 1 to the nth derivative, like the first part of that number 3. So page 95, like that, part A. I was wondering if you could, like, I'm pretty sure it's like, I had like something like integration by parts, but like I couldn't quite get it to work. I was like wondering if you could show me like how to do that.
Oh, I don't think I can do it now, but
okay.
Let's see, show that, I mean, this identity. It's an induction.
No, the first one.
That one. It's an induction. And it's integration by parts plus induction.
Yeah, basically it is like almost exactly like integration by parts, except there's like n derivatives instead of like.
It means you have to do it in.
I know. I tried like moving it over.
There's
like,
a
one
quick
at
way
a time.
To do integration by parts that's kind of handy, is you do it over and over again. Remember this chart with the arrows on it when you do integration by parts.
Okay.
It's not pretty,
like that,
I guess, but
okay,
it comes out after you see what the induction would be.
Well, yeah, so, like, the induction, I kind of did induction where it was, like, you integrate by parts one time, and you see that that first integration by parts has the correct, like, form.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do it, like, you say for any, like, if you have it of this form, then the next one's going to be of that form, too. And then you can show that that holds for any like k less, strictly less than n. So in particular, it holds for k equals n minus 1.
Yeah.
You plug that in, and then you get the thing.
Yeah, that's a form of induction. What's that called?
Complete
induction.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the various forms of mathematical induction. Yeah.
Okay. Because it shows it for like that particular n. Which can be any n. Like, yeah, it wasn't like induction in the sense that I was used to.
Uh-huh.
Like, show it.